You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
Welcome to Before They Were Live, an ongoing, monthly, and extremely nerdy conversation through the land of fairy, or the perilous realm. In his seminal essay on fairy stories, J.R.R. Tolkien says that he has hardly been more than a wandering explorer or trespasser in the land, full of wonder, but not of information. And we take the same tack. We are, as ever, interested in playing our part in healthy ecosystem of art and criticism and fandom, paying attention to the way stories have shaped our collective imaginations and how they help us survive and thrive. The once upon a time keeps alive our utopian longing for a better world that can be created out of our dreams and actions, says Jack Zipes, whose edition we are reading. Anyway, we are happy to ladle out a bowlful from the great cauldron of story that has been bubbling and boiling for centuries. So pull up a chair to our table, grab yourself a soup bowl and a big old chunk of homemade bread, and help us enrich this reading experience and have some fun too. We've got nine more Brothers Grimm's fairy stories for you today. A few may be familiar, a few may not be. We will retell them slash summarize them here if you haven't read them, so feel free to listen along either way. Joining me, as always, to tell these stories and talk them over, this is a man about whom, when he was born, it was prophesied that fortune would shine on him in all his endeavors. It's Michael Farmer.
Fortune's favorite himself. How's it going, Josh?
It's good. It's good to be talking these over with you again after our little mini hiatus that we didn't mean to have. So,
right. Yeah, I guess it's been 5 weeks for our listeners.
Yeah. So it's good to be back. So here we are. We've got nine stories. They are in the order of the book. They're The Devil with the Golden Hairs, The Maiden Without Hands, The Magic Table, The Golden Donkey, and The Club in the Sack, Thumbling, The Elves, The Juniper Tree, and a couple more, The Six Swans, King Thrushbeard, and Sweetheart Roland. Is that right? Did I get them all?
That's right. And I would say the only one of these that was familiar to me going in was one of the elves stories, because the elves is actually three stories. And then I think I had heard probably some version of Thumbling. I mean, I remember growing up reading Tom Thumb. And I think I might have heard some version of The Magic Table, The Golden Donkey, and The Club in the Sack. That sounded... I have kind of a semi-vivid memory of a table setting itself in a children's book.
Yeah, there's actually a Disney version of the table.
Oh, interesting.
Not a cartoon. It's a, you know, they have the, you know, Disney is such a wide empire, but they have fairy tales retold with our, you know, favorite Disney friends. So in that one, it's Donald Duck and Huey, Dewey, and Louie are the ones.
I can definitely see Donald Duck acting like the dad in The Magic Table. So
yeah,
that's actually a pretty good casting choice.
Yeah, so that was the one I was familiar with, was that version. Although I didn't come across that until I was an adult. That wasn't one that I came across as a kid. But there was some point where somebody passed along to us a bunch of these, you know, 1970s Disney, or maybe even older than that, I don't know, Disney fairy tale books, and that was one of them. So that was kind of fun to come across the real version, or whatever you want to call it. I don't know if real is the right word, but you know what I mean.
We mostly version. Have not been picking the big name stories, though, because Rumpelstiltskin is in this set, and also Snow White, and we didn't do either one of those. So we've been trying to keep off the beaten path a little bit.
Yeah, and that's not entirely intentional on my part, at least. It's just I try and pick the ones that are interesting to me, and I think it's a little, for me, it's more interesting to run into the ones that I'm not as familiar with. So
part of it is, like, if you don't know the stories, they feel so foreign because the storytelling techniques are so different than modern storytelling techniques. And you lose that if you've grown up hearing the story of Rumpelstiltskin or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, that story is so familiar that even reading it now, the weirdness of it didn't register. But something like, gosh, The Devil with the Three Golden Hairs is just such a bizarre story that it's hard not to want to talk about it, although I think that's one you picked.
Yes, it is. And so we can jump into it.
Let's jump into it.
The first one, and that is, yeah,
exactly. We are doing the first one in the section and the last one of the section. I wanted to point that out as well, the 100 pages we read.
Oh, yeah, that's funny.
And you picked both of them.
Those are both my picks, too, yeah, yeah. So there's something probably to that, in the psychology, they talk about you remember the first and the last things better than the things in the middle. So that is probably what happened to me. But anyway, The Devil with the Three Golden Hairs. I'm going to try and summarize this briefly, but like I just said a moment ago, it's difficult to know what's going to be important. So once upon a time, there was a poor woman who gave birth to a little son. And since he was born with a caul, it was prophesied he would marry the king's daughter by the time he was 14. Michael, do you know what a caul is? I had to look it up.
I vaguely know it's something that sometimes infants emerge from the womb wrapped around them, right? It's like the blood sac that covers them in the womb.
Exactly. It's some sort of membrane or something that, yeah. So anyway, I had to look that one up, but for the good of our listeners, I just thought I'd throw that in there. Okay. Anyway, there's an evil king. He hears this prophecy. He's not pleased. He doesn't want a lowborn marrying his daughter. So he disguises himself, goes to the parents, offers them a lot of money for the child. The parents know that their child is fortune's favorite, and so they see this as a good thing. They sell their child to the king, the evil king, who puts him in a box, throws him in a river. Why a box? I don't know. But anyway, it floats down the river. It doesn't sink as the king was hoping. And a miller finds him, and a miller and his wife were praying for a child, and so this is a blessing for them, and they raise this child. 14 years later, the evil king gets caught in a thunderstorm and takes refuge at the mill. He sees the boy about. He inquires about him. And finds out that he was a foundling. So even though this is an evil king, he's no dummy. He realizes that this is the same boy he had thrown in the water. So he asks the miller if this son could take a message to the queen for him. And the king writes a letter telling the queen to have the boy killed immediately upon reading the letter or receiving the letter. But fortunately for our hero, I guess, he gets lost on the way to the castle. He ends up in a cottage in the woods. Often in these stories, when you end up in a cottage in the woods, it belongs to it's a den of thieves. But then also often there's an old woman there, like a grandmother of the thieves or something.
Somebody's got to do the thieves' laundry and stuff, I think is the implication.
Yeah,
you can't expect these 18th century thieves to like be interested in doing their own cooking and cleaning.
Yeah, sure. So anyway, this old woman takes pity on him,
It occurs to me, Josh, to interrupt you again, that like when you find an old woman in the woods in Grimm's, you know it's going to go one of two ways: either she's going to be a witch, or she's going to be somebody's grandmother and take care of you.
Yeah,
and you really can't tell until it's already happened.
That's very true. But almost guaranteed there will be thieves and robbers involved somewhere along the way, one way or the other. Anyway, she does take pity on him, he's too tired to escape anyway. Like, she warns him to escape, but he says, I'm too tired. And so anyway, the robbers show up. They read the letter, and they also take pity on him. And they forge a new letter saying, instead of kill this boy immediately, marry this boy to the princess immediately upon arrival. And so the prophecy comes true. The king arrives. He is shocked, and, you know, this is the opposite of what he wanted to happen. So he tells the boy if he wants to keep his pride, he needs to get his bride, he needs to get three golden hairs from the head of the devil. So the boy heads off to hell. He's happy to do this. He knows that he can succeed at this task. On his way, he comes across two cities, and in both cities, he speaks to the watchman, and he also comes upon a ferryman. And the watchman and the ferryman, they all ask him the same question about where he's going, what he knows. And every time, he replies that he knows everything. And so every time, the watchman or the ferryman ask him a question that they are puzzling over, and the boy always promises an answer upon his return. So finally, the boy makes it to hell, and the devil isn't at home, but his grandmother is there. Lovely. And so the boy tells her that he wants the 3 golden hairs, and he also tells her the 3 riddles that he's collected on his way. So she says, okay, no problem. She turns him into an ant and hides him in her dress. So pretty soon the devil returns, and the grandmother says, you know, lay down here. And she starts looking for lice in his head. He falls asleep, and each time he falls asleep, she grabs a hair out, and he gets angry. And each time she claims it was a mistake and says that she has a bad dream. And each time the devil, like, because he's angry, but he loses the anger over his curiosity and says, what were you dreaming about? And each time she tricks him by presenting the riddles that the boys have come up with. So the first time she tells him there's a city with a fountain that used to gush with wine, but it stopped flowing and doesn't even have water anymore. And the devil tells her there's a toad underneath a stone. And if they remove that toad, then it would then the wine would flow again. And then the second one, she says there's a city with a tree with golden apples, but the tree no longer bears apples or even leaves. And the devil tells her there's a moss gnawing on the roots. And the third time she says there's a ferryman, and he always has to ferry people back and forth. And the devil says that this guy is just a fool, and he just needs to hand his pole over to someone. So finally, the devil goes to sleep for the fourth time. The grandmother really puts him to sleep this time. She re-transforms the boy. Says, did you hear the answers to all your riddles? He says, yes. And he goes on his way. And then on his way back, he, you know, tells the answers to the riddles to everyone. So the ferryman's happy to hear that he just has to give his pole away. The watchmen, you know, they discover the mouse and the toad in the cities. They're thrilled. And so they give him donkeys laden with gold. So finally he arrives home, and his wife is happy to see him. Everything is going to be, you know, great for him. The king asks where he got all the gold from. And he says, oh, it's free for taking on the other side of the river. So the greedy king runs to the ferryman. The ferryman puts the pole in the king's hand. The king is still there ferrying people back and forth to this day.
Very simple story.
Yeah. I think it's a really fun story. It's just, it's not the longest that we're going to encounter. I think it's the longest of today's, maybe. But
no, one of the ones we're going to do next month, because we've already picked them, is like 15 pages or something.
Yeah, we might have to break it into parts. But anyway, so that's the gist of the story. It's actually, you know, it's the funny thing of doing this, like, kind of summarizing style. You can tell, like, I mean, you could imagine, like, if you were just listening to a story, like if you were just going to listen to the story, they'd tell it a little more. You know, with the patterns. I tried to condense the patterns, but, you know, it's kind of fun reading it with the pattern of, like, he falls asleep, wakes up, you know, here's the question. You've heard the question a couple times by this point, because you've heard it from the Watchmen, and then you've heard it, you know. So anyway, you have to forgive me, listeners, and imagine it that way, or go get a copy.
Wait, and you get that with really any of these literary forms that are originally oral. So if you read Homer's Iliad or Odyssey, there's all these, like, repeated things, because it's the guy who's telling the story, and he has just kind of a, I forget what it's called, but he has a just kind of patter he does from time to time, right. Either because he's improvising and he needs time to think of new stuff, or because it's just part of the art form.
Yeah,
but if you're not reading it, that comes off less annoying, I think, than when you read it. I think when you read it, it's, why are they saying the exact same thing twice or 3 times? It's always 3 times.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing I noticed that was like must have been a holdover is, this cannot possibly be the Christian devil. Like, this has got to be some sort of pagan religious figure who's just survived into the fairy tale era. Because it's obviously not Satan. He's omniscient, and he has a grandmother. I don't know enough about Germanic folklore to know, like, what this character must have evolved from. But I think trying to think of this as Lucifer, the fallen angel, is a way to misunderstand who he is.
Right. A kind of fun way to misunderstand who he is. I was really trying to, like, I was really fascinated by the idea of Lucifer having a grandmother. So
do you think she's, like, disappointed in him, but still, you know, he's still her grandson, so she still loves him, but she's still proud of him in a
right.
way.
Yeah.
I'm not a grandmother, so I don't know. I don't know what it is to be one, but, like, I feel like that's how you would feel if you were the devil's grandmother.
Yeah, I was really
nice of him to let her live with him, though.
Yeah, definitely. I was really fascinated by it. There's actually another story that we will read in the future called The Devil's Grandmother, but it offers no more information about her than this one did. I was a little disappointed. I read ahead just to find out story.
You know, you really don't turn to these stories for character development or like depth of character. It's a little bit like it's a little bit like the old movies where it's really about some sort of spectacle almost. I don't even know. Like it's modern readers definitely want like rounded characters, and they want, you know, the good guys to be kind of bad and the bad guys to be kind of good, and you want to see yourself in these people. And that is just, if you go to these stories looking for that kind of character development, you're going to be disappointed because they're not really interested in character at all. It's almost entirely plot driven.
Yeah, that is very true. But yeah, I think like you said, like I was curious if there was going to be a little more information about this like Germanic backstory or something, you know, like something to tell me about a little more about who she was. But you're right. Like in general, they're not interested in character. Although I did notice this time, there's more, I think there was more in this section of the, you know, don't you wish you were there, or I can see by your the look on your face that you wish you were there. So they did somehow involve the reader in the story. It just wasn't in the way that we expect, you know?
Yeah. I forget the one I read a few days ago that was like, and I wish I was there and you were too at this wedding, because we would have, it might've been one of the ones we're talking about. It might be Sweetheart Roland actually.
Yeah. I think it may be. Yeah. So,
The other thing this reminded me of, while we're talking about the Iliad and the Odyssey, is Oedipus Rex, Oedipus the King, the Sophocles play, because in both, it involves this kid who is born destined to do something, and they try to avoid that fate, and yet he ends up doing it anyway. So like the further you try to run away from your fate, the more you actually run into it. Only here, obviously, it's a good thing and not a bad thing, whereas in Oedipus, you know, spoiler alert, he kills his father and marries his mother.
Yeah. Not so great.
Fortune's favorite is fated to marry the king's daughter, and nothing the king does can stop him from doing that. And in fact, you get this like truly ludicrous scene where the robbers, who are described as being hard-hearted, even though they're much better than the king, the robbers feel so bad for him that they change this letter so that he's going to marry the king's daughter, which they couldn't possibly have known about this prophecy. Could they? It's like fortune or fate or whatever you want to call it, providence, is writing the story, and all these characters are just the kind of pen they're using. It's using to write it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wrote in my notes, is it fortune that is granting him the pity of others? Is that like what the fortune really is, you know?
Well, he doesn't have a personality, right? So we don't see it in him. It's not like we find him overwhelmingly charming. He's not even one of these tricksters, and we'll talk about another one of these tricksters soon. And the tricksters really are kind of charming, and you can kind of see how they get ahead in this world. But Fortune's favorite is just kind of a blank, right? Like he doesn't do anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're told that he is educated in virtue by the miller and his wife. And he is capable of lying to all these people and telling them that he knows everything. And that's about all the personality you get from him.
Yeah. Forging of letters was a surprising / unexpected fairy tale trope.
Yeah, what's the other one? Is there another one we're talking about?
Yeah, the maiden without hands has it in there too.
Yeah. So I'd be interested in knowing when that became a common plot point in the telling of the stories, because that's a plot point that doesn't make a lot of sense until you get widespread literacy.
Yeah,
but I don't have a sense of how far back any of these stories go.
Well, and I was wondering the same thing, and I was wondering if it almost arose out of like a forging of a letter would almost be an unheard of occurrence perhaps until you have widespread literacy, right? And that was something where I wondered if it got added to the story as almost a type of like, you know, a bubbling up of like, oh, this is a fear of, you know, that we haven't had to deal with in the past, you know, or something. Or even the, you know, the idea of authorship is very different for us these days than it would have been for people in the past, you know, like they
right.
They
would, yeah, because who wrote these, you know?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
We could attribute them to the Grimms, and I'm sure the Grimms had like an editorial process they went through. I'm sure in some ways we are getting the Grimms' words, but on the other hand, I think the idea is they're writing it down as they heard it. Of course, whoever they hear it from is just the most recent person to tell the story. And presumably, when it gets told by all these people over the course of decades or centuries, the story is going to take on the kind of cast of whoever is telling the story.
Right.
And this is also, I suspect, why the stories are so shaggy, because everybody is just adding whatever details interest them.
Yeah.
And eventually those details just end up as part of the story. I don't know anything about oral tradition. I never studied it at all. But this sure makes me wish I did.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot in this that makes me wish I studied more. I actually I ordered a book. It hasn't arrived yet, but I ordered it this month because I was like, I'm really curious about some of this. And you know, just the preview on Google Books or whatever, the guy in the preface was kind of making an argument that, you know, we don't really know how old these stories are, but the forms of them, you can connect them all the way back to, you know, some of the mythical forms that we have, you know, so these stories could be as old as those, you know, or at least pulling from, you know, they're at least pulling from some of those same threads, that cauldron of soup that I alluded to in our introduction. You know, I think I stole that from either C.S. Lewis or Tolkien or both, you know, or probably many, many places, just the same as this oral tradition, you know, but that idea of like, you know, everything gets thrown into this giant cauldron of soup, and then we're all just dipping our ladles in and pulling it out when we tell stories. So
what's the name of the book you ordered?
I will tell you next month.
Okay.
I can tell you now, but I don't have it right in front of me and I don't remember. It's the Golden Slipper or something like that. It's like finding the spiritual symbolism inside the Grimm's fairy tales or something like that, you know.
Gotcha.
Something like
again, I know nothing. I've read Lewis's book on stories and I read on fairy stories by J.R.R. Tolkien, but this is so far from being my area of expertise that it's kind of nice to just come in with very little knowledge of what it's talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really fun.
So are we ready to move on to The Maiden Without Hands, or do you have anything else to say about Devil with the Three Golden Hairs?
Well, I was just going to say, speaking of the perhaps even like mythological roots of this stuff, I was wondering if like, you know, when there's a story that's like, for me, it immediately, at the beginning when he's like getting pulled out of the water, right? Like, it's like a Moses type thing. And I was like,
yes.
Is something like that, like, is it supposed to inform us? Like, are we supposed to, like, are we supposed to somehow read Moses into that? Or is it just kind of a, you know, oh, this is a trope in storytelling now because it's a familiar story, you know?
And yeah, I really don't know. And Moses is not the only ancient figure that particular story gets told about. Sargon, who is an ancient Akkadian, I think, king, one of the first emperors, he that story is told about him as well. Also, it's a story that's true of kind of Oedipus himself, who the king, when he gets this prophecy that he's going to kill his father and marry his mother, the king's like, hey, take him up there and kill him, please, so that he's not going to do that. Mm-hmm. And the shepherd can't bring himself to do it, and so he ends up getting adopted by another king. You know, so, I mean, it is just kind of part of the human heritage, almost. I don't know much about Far East mythology or anything like that, but it seems to me that these are pretty universal tropes. The idea of like a foundling child growing up to be of some importance.
Yeah. So anyway, that's. I think it's really, really interesting. You know, it's like, why, you know, like why does that become a trope? But it's cool. Like it's cool to kind of trace it, you know?
Yeah. Well, The Maid Without Hands, and our listeners from last month will remember that Josh tells these in a very formal way. And I tell them in a very informal way. And that's just kind of the fun of doing both of us.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, there's this guy, he's a miller and he's poor and he wants to be rich. So this guy appears to him and he's like, hey, I'll make you rich if you'll give me whatever you've got behind your mill. When the farmer thinks about it, and the only thing behind his mill is an apple tree that doesn't bear apples. So he's like, oh, well, sure. Yeah, you make me rich and you can have whatever's behind the mill. Well, it turns out, of course, that the guy who made this deal with the miller is actually the devil. And his daughter was behind the mill at the time the story happened. And so in 3 years, the devil is going to come for this guy's daughter. And this guy's daughter is really pious and really wonderful. And of course she's beautiful. And so she stays pure. And when the devil comes for her, he has a really hard time getting her because she keeps like purifying herself ritually. And so finally he gets the miller to cut off his daughter's hands. But even then she like cries tears of sorrow and it purifies her. And so she can't be taken by the devil, and the devil just kind of gives up. But at the same time, the daughter is disgusted with her father, who has cut off her hands, because he's too afraid of the devil to stand up to him. And so she just kind of goes off to make her way in the wide world. And God takes care of her. First, he sends her an angel that will help her like eat the fruit in this garden. And then God has the king who owns this garden fall in love with her. But here again, the devil comes in and messes things up, and he convinces this king that the maiden is a cannibal, and that she's eaten their son. And so she ends up going off once again. And she ends up in the forest, of course, in a cabin that has a sign that says free lodging for everyone, where her piety is so great that her hands actually grow back. I didn't say this, but she had been given silver hands, but she doesn't need those anymore because her real hands grow back because she's so pious. And then finally, the king ends up going on a 7-year quest to find her, where he doesn't eat or drink the whole time. And then he finally does find her, and they live happily ever after once he realizes it's the same woman. So again, another story that Disney is probably never going to make a Mickey Mouse short out of.
Yeah, no, probably not. I don't think so. I think the king was never entirely convinced that she was evil, but like or is it in this story or is it the other?
This is not the cannibal story. That's right. This is the story where the king becomes convinced that their son is a changeling.
Right. Yeah. Well, but he's still willing to protect her. But every time he sends a letter, the devil changes it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. There is a lot of cannibalism today.
Yeah, when we started reading these a few months ago, I texted Josh and said, hey, there's way more baby eating in this set of stories than in the last one.
Yeah, but I think part of that is, I'm not sure, you know, when the Grimms were putting these together, like you can really see themes like story to story. So I don't know if like there's certain things where like they're like, okay, let's put all the baby eating ones next to each other. Yeah. Or what.
But you definitely next month we're going to get three about the wolf and the fox right next to each other.
Yeah.
So I suspect it's not just these happen to be the order they were told the stories in. I'm sure they had some means of putting them in order.
Yeah, for sure.
So like this story seems to be much more straightforward than the last one. It has less of a Shaggy Dog quality to it. This is a story about a woman who is very pious and very obedient, and God rewards her for it, right? Like she does what is expected of her. She keeps herself pure, and the devil can't touch her. And even when the devil does get at her, God ends up protecting her and making everything right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has a very like life of a saint, like a how do you pronounce that word?
Hagiography.
Yeah, like kind of feel to it, you know.
Yeah, it does.
I have not read a lot of hagiographies, or maybe none, but it's the way I imagine they go, you know. Super pious, and a lot of miraculous things happening around them because they're so pious.
Right. Yeah, and the thing about her hands growing back, for example.
Yeah.
She's suffered enough and she's pious enough that, okay, it's time for that miracle to take place, even though presumably God could have done that from the beginning. Instead, he lets her suffer and he lets her prove her piety.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of the ones we read for today where I thought, okay, so Germany's an interesting place, right, because it's half Catholic and half Protestant. And a lot of these feel more Catholic to me because that one in particular feels like participation, cooperation with grace. Mm-hmm. Where it's not just something that's done for her. It's done because of her piety. So the miracle takes place because she obeys God, not just because God makes the miracle take place.
Right. But on the other hand, maybe this is Protestant reading versus Catholic reading. I don't know. I was really like, Like she loses her hands. Like hands are like a symbol of like your ability to do any sort of work, you know?
That's true.
And so like she's like completely loved by this king, because the king, when the king meets her, she's already lost her hands, you know?
Right.
And so like he loves her out of, you know, just her purity, like not anything that she's doing per se, you know? Like she's not going to be able to, you know, keep house or anything.
No, but I mean, it's a good thing he's a king and presumably has a small army of servants.
Yes, yeah.
He's not just a woodcutter.
Yeah, less important, maybe. So, yeah. I saw a couple biblical things in here, allusions too. Like the father at the beginning makes a very Jephthah type style. Yeah,
it's a very Jephthah type deal, isn't it?
Yeah, where he's like, yeah, sure, whatever's behind the woodshed, without ever thinking about like, yeah, what's back there, you know?
Tell me.
Well, he does think about it, but he doesn't expect that his daughter would be there. So,
I think if it had been me, I would have been like, so just to be clear, what you want is the apple tree behind my mill.
Yeah.
But I guess we all think that we would outsmart the devil if given the opportunity.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you pick up, there's a substitutionary atonement here too with the dough. The mother-in-law sacrifices the dough to convince the king that that she's killed the queen like she said she was going to.
Right. Yeah. I did not pick up on that, but you're right. Yeah, there is that. Because he doesn't actually want her killed. Like, so she brings him that stuff and he's like, what? You killed my wife? I wrote you a letter telling you not to. And she's like, oh, you know, your letter told me to do it. So, yeah. But you're right. It still works. It works either way, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that one is right out of Snow White, too.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very Snow Whitey in that way. But then when the king arrives at the inn, the free lodging for all inn, with the where the mom and the son are, he covers his face, and his like the covering, his handkerchief or whatever, keeps falling on the floor, and she has her son keep replacing the covering, and I don't know. It gave me kind of like Noah vibes, you know, like Noah. There's that weird, super weird story with Noah and Ham and Japheth, and Ham uncovers his father and Japheth covers him, you know, and Japheth is the righteous one because he covers his father. And so I don't know that there was something about that. I was like, oh, that just seems resonant to me.
Oh, I didn't think about that at all. But I noticed, like, there's certainly, like, a holiness to that action, right? That's why he's covering himself. And that's why he doesn't eat or drink for 7 years when he goes on that. So it's like a penitential quest he's on.
Right.
He's unworthy of this woman, even though he didn't really do anything wrong, I suppose.
Yeah. But it all works out, so.
Free lodging for everyone.
Free lodging for everyone.
Total grace.
Yep.
All right. Shall we talk about the magic table, etc.?
I suppose so, yeah.
This is another one of mine. I did the next three in a row, so I apparently stopped reading halfway through. I found the ones I was interested in, and those are the ones I picked. All right, so this is another one of those stories that's really like three or four stories kind of smashed together. So we begin with, it's another Miller, right? Or is he a tailor? He's a tailor.
Yeah, he's a tailor this time.
Yeah, so it's a tailor with three sons and a goat. And one by one, he sends his sons out to graze the goat. And it's a talking goat. Plot twist. And one by one, the sons will say, hey, did you get enough to eat, goat? And the goat will be like, yeah, I couldn't eat any more. And then they go back and the goat reports to the father that they didn't feed him at all. They basically, or her at all. She basically only ate dry leaves, and she was abused by these sons. And for some reason, instead of like addressing the issue with the sons, the father immediately takes the goat's word for things and drives the sons away. And he does this to all three of them. And that's the kind of impetus of the story. You get like a reverse prodigal son, where these three good sons are driven away by their father, who is, if not evil, he's at least stupid. And I think there's some sense that he's kind of a bad guy, because really what he wants from his sons is for them to come home so he doesn't have to work anymore, so they'll do all the work for him. And so when they each do come home with a magical object, every time he thinks, ah, maybe I can stop sewing. So he's not what you would call a diligent worker. So out in the world, each one of the sons gets a job as an apprentice to a master. And each of them at the end of their apprenticeship is given a magical object. And they assume that with this magical object, they can come home and buy their father's love for them. It's really kind of sad if you think about it. So the first one is the magic table. And this guy, I think he apprenticed with a carpenter. And the magic table, if you can say the magic words, which I think are table cover yourself. And the most sumptuous food in the world will appear on the table and you can eat your fill. And then, you know, you can say uncover and the food will go away and it'll just be a regular table again. So pretty cool gift. You know, if you think about it, you'd probably never have to work again because you'd always have food to eat. And if nothing else, you could just sell the food. So the guy's going home and he stops at this inn and the innkeeper is very poor and the son is a very nice person. And he thinks, hey, well, how about you be my guest? And so he, you know, feeds him using this magic table. And the innkeeper turns out not to be a great guy. And he in the middle of the night, he switches the table for a regular table. And when the first son gets home, he looks like a fool in front of his father because what he says is a magic table doesn't do anything at all. That's son number one. Son number two becomes a miller, and he is given a magical donkey, which when you say Bricklebrit, the donkey will spit out gold coins, which again, that's a remarkably good gift to give somebody, I would say. Well, he stops at that same inn, and this time while he doesn't like show off the donkey to the innkeeper, nevertheless, the innkeeper like looks through a keyhole or something and sees him doing this and switches the donkey in the middle of the night with a regular donkey. And the second son goes home and tells the father that he has a magical donkey and looks like a fool when it turns out that his donkey does not spit gold coins. Well, I guess it doesn't say this directly, but I guess the first two sons talk about it together and figure out that they've been ripped off by the same innkeeper. And so they write a letter to the third son and tell him what's happened. And it just so happens he works at a lathe, so he's a turner, and he gets his magical gift is a sack with a club in it, which you can use the club to beat somebody within an inch of their life. And so what he does is he goes to the innkeeper and uses the club on him until he gets the donkey and the table back. And then he brings everything home and there's this magnificent feast and showering of gold. And everybody lived happily ever after, except for the goat. The goat was shaven because the father figured out that the goat had lied to him. The goat was shaven and the other animals made fun of it, I believe, and it got stung by a bee and it ran away and nobody has heard of it until this day, which seems like kind of a weird weird little coda to the story. It seems not entirely necessary, but maybe it's all in the way you tell it.
Yeah. Two parts to that coda. One part was these stories so often, as you keep saying, they've got that Shaggy Dog quality where like characters come in and they drop out and you never hear from them again. So it was really bizarre that they were like, well, what about the goat? Because in like all the other tales we've read, it's like, well, what about the dad or the stepmom?
Yeah, in The Maid Without Hands, the girl's father who cut her hands off disappears from the story forever.
Yep, no coda about him.
But we were all wondering what happened to that goat.
I think you said something in there, though, about like the diligence or lack of diligence of the father. And I don't know. The goat. So I've got two things and they're kind of like loosely related, but maybe they're supposed to be related in the story. So like, you know, at the end times, obviously, for people familiar with their, you know, biblical eschatology, Jesus is going to separate the sheep from the goats.
True.
And, the father seems to identify closely with the goat. Like he believes the goats over his son. And then even when the second son comes home and has the,
The donkey. The donkey. Because he's like, I wish you would have brought me a goat.
Yeah, I wish you would have brought a goat. Exactly. So, like, there really seems to be some sort of identification with the goat and the father. And then a bee is kind of known for its diligence, right? Like, they're kind
of symbolic of diligence. Point.
And so I was wondering if that coda was to kind of just highlight that point of the father, like, not being diligent, and the, you know, identifying with the goat is also not diligent, or something. I don't know. That may be too far a leap to make, but that's the best I got.
I mean, there's also, I suppose, a reason why a tailor would want a goat instead of a donkey. Like, if you were doing agriculture or milling or other stuff where you would need to carry a lot of heavy stuff, a donkey would make a lot of sense, but a tailor is probably not going to have a lot of use for it. Whereas the goat is going to produce, if nothing else, milk.
Right.
And probably, I guess he could also make some mohair sweaters or something. I'm not sure if in Germany they use goat hair to make clothes or not.
Yeah.
But right. The father does seem overly attached to goats.
Yeah. And I was trying to figure out, like, this story was really confusing to me. And I mean, I enjoyed it. Like, it's funny. I understand why Disney used it, because it is, like, for a storybook, you know, because it is kind of a humorous tale, especially, like, you know, just the innkeeper getting what's coming to him, you know, with the club that'll beat you within an inch of your life or whatever.
It beats him so hard that his clothes split.
Yeah, it doesn't sound great. He needs a tailor.
That's true. Too bad the only tailor we know is not going to be a tailor anymore, because now he has a donkey that spits gold.
Yeah. Yeah. But the like you said, as you were telling it, like, these gifts are outrageous, you know? Like, who would ever give them? And you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, do the masters just have... I mean, I guess the magic club, I can understand giving it to a young man making his way in the world.
Yeah.
But the other two, I feel like I wouldn't give away the magic table unless I had another magic table. Like, maybe I'd give my old one.
Right.
You know, like, maybe the new one is is an extra, like, 10 feet long or something.
Right.
So it's maybe, more food.
Yeah. I guess maybe he's that good of a master carpenter that he's just building these magic tables, and that's why he can give them away to his apprentices. I don't know. Like, that part of the story has always been, like, a little confusing to me. It's like, well, why is he still practicing carpentry? You know, I mean, I guess out of the love of it, maybe just. Out of,
yeah. Maybe he, even though he wouldn't have to, he still does.
Yeah. But I mean, but I guess
also the generosity of those masters really shows you how greedy and selfish the innkeeper is, especially with the first son, who is, like, helping him. He's doing something incredibly nice for him. He even says, I think, I'm going to make you my guest.
Right.
And the innkeeper just sees an opportunity to get ahead in the world.
Yeah.
So no, I think that contrast is there.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's what we're really supposed to be latching onto. Like, I think it's probably a little too much of our desire for modern storytelling. That's like, well, wait a second, this doesn't quite make sense. I think you just hit it on the head there, though, of, like, this is really a story about generosity. Because even at the end, like, you know, it's not just that they make their father rich, but they invite all the family over.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think this is the one that says, you probably wish you were there too. You know, like,
yeah, I could get my hands on the magic donkey.
Right. Yeah. So I think this is, you're right, that the idea here is much more a story of just, I don't know, radical generosity or something.
Well, and abundance, right? Because you get the thing the goat complains about is that the goat's not getting enough food, even though it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first two gifts, the third one really is atypical, but the first two gifts are gifts about generosity. And the donkey is, like, spitting up a stupid amount of gold too. It's not like he spits out one gold coin every time you say Bricklebrit. You have to put a blanket underneath him to collect all the gold he's spitting up.
Right.
So, yeah, you've definitely got that abundance, which is also definitely a biblical image, right? Like, a lot of Jesus's miracles are. His first miracle is the wedding at Cana, which is, you know, more wine than any human party would ever be able to drink. Nevertheless, shows up there, and there's some of that in the in the table as well, that it's this like really rich food. And the innkeeper, the thing that amazes him the most is that as soon as you finish one dish, it replenishes itself. So you like you would never run out, which you could see how it would be really good to have that as an innkeeper. One wonders why he didn't go to the son and say, hey, why don't we go in business together?
Right. Yeah. And I think that, again, is the contrast, because you're right. Like there's this abundance there. There's an abundance available. But instead of, you know, participating in the abundance, he wants to just hoard it. Right.
Right.
Whereas the good son is willing to share that abundance and, you know, bring everybody into enjoy the table. That's good. That helped me talking that through.
Me too. I really liked that one.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. I was a little confused about it. I feel a lot better after we talked about it.
Well, let's see if we can make sense of Thumbling. Thumbling is a childless couple, and they don't have a child. And the mother says, boy, I would love a child, even if it was no bigger than my thumb. And lo and behold, 7 months later, not 9 months, 7 months, 7 months later, she gives birth to a child that is no bigger than her thumb. But she does love him, just like she promised she would. And he ends up being kind of a trickster character. And so we see him get into some monkey shines here. He's out with his dad one day, and these two guys want to buy him so they can make a bunch of money exhibiting him in the city. And the father is rightly horrified by this. But Thumbling's like, no, hey, wait, take the money. And then he runs off and hides from them after they've already paid the father. And then he overhears some thieves who are going to rob the wealthy pastor. And he tells them that he'll help them do that. And then instead he alerts the maid, I think, that they're trying to do that. And so they don't get to rob the wealthy pastor. And from then on, he's not really a trickster figure. The story kind of takes a turn. He ends up being swallowed by the pastor's cow, and he's afraid that he's going to suffocate in the cow's stomach with all the fodder coming in. So he starts yelling, no more fodder. And they think that the devil has possessed the cow, and they kill it. And then once they've killed the cow, he's still in the cow's stomach, and a wolf eats the stomach, just swallows the whole thing whole. And he talks to the wolf and convinces him to go essentially rob Thumbling's parents. But the wolf eats so much in their cellar that he gets stuck down there, and the father and the mother easily come, kill the wolf and free Thumbling, and they all live happily ever after. Which, you know, I don't remember what version of Tom Thumb I heard when I was a kid, but I don't think it was this one.
Yeah, for myself, I know of these like stories, you know, Tom Thumb, Thumbelina. You know, like all these, but like I couldn't tell you plot points of any. I just, you know, they're tiny people is all I know. So I don't remember myself like hearing a story like this one at all. This one is the idea of selling your children. That's another thing that comes up a lot, I feel like, in these stories. Just like really really weird, but yeah.
Well, here I was interested in that because of what they're going to sell him for. It's not because he's going to do any work. They're going to sell him to a freak show, basically.
Yeah, he's going to be like
Which, to be fair, it would be a way for a person who is as big as a thumb to make a living.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But it's got a lot of those elements that we see in some of the other stories. Like Little Red Riding Hood getting eaten by a wolf, but then, you know, able to miraculously come back out of that. No big deal, you know.
It also reminded me of The Brave Little Tailor, the way Thumbling is described as a clever and nimble fellow who succeeded in all his endeavors. That's very similar to the language used about The Brave Little Tailor. So he's our trickster this time. And I didn't look it up, but I am certain that there are Disney and Warner Brothers adaptations of Thumbling because it is such a colorful story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't look it up either because I'm not as familiar with the Thumbling stories, but I wouldn't be surprised to see them.
And it's worth pointing out there is another Thumbling story in the same section we read for today. It's like The Travels of Thumbling or something like that.
Yeah, that may be.
It's a very similar story, but it's a you know, it's a different continuity.
Yeah.
It doesn't like pick up where this one left off or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah, we read so many of these that the details all blur together in my head sometimes. So.
I read the 100 pages and I make my 5 pick, and then a couple days before we record, I go back and read in detail the ones we're actually talking about. So yeah, there's a bunch of them I don't remember.
Yeah. Which I think is kind of like just that point, just quick side point. Like it's kind of interesting. Like were these like, you know, obviously there's the tales that we do remember, you know, that have gotten told, like, you know, Snow White and Rumpelstiltskin and stuff like that. You know, it's not like there's a dearth of fairy tales. It's just that there's so many in this book. And like, I just wonder about that. Like were people in the past more familiar? Like could they just rip off, you know, how many fairy tales are in this book, 400 or something?
But surely not, right? Like surely a given family would have the stories they told.
Yeah.
And I mean, to some extent, that's still true. The monoculture did kind of eliminate that. But even so, there's like children's books of these that, you know, we've talked about how important Musicians of Bremen was to me when I was a kid, for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
But probably because I must have had a good illustrated version of it. Whereas that story wasn't important to you, right?
Right.
Right. So I feel like that's still to some extent true, but when it was still oral culture, it was just whichever ones your family knew, and they didn't exist in a shared collection really until the Grimms came and put them together. Now that's an oversimplification too, because there's people who are writing them down before the Grimmses, but certainly these 400 or whatever are
like 250, it's not 400.
It's 800 pages anyway.
Yes. Yeah. It's a thick book.
Cause Charles Perrault in France had already written his versions of these stories down in the century before the Grimms. So, I mean, it's not like they're the first person to collect any of them, but I don't know that people would have thought of them all as being part of the same grouping. I think probably it was like, here are the stories my mother told me when I was growing up, and mm-hmm. so I'm going to tell you guys.
Right. Yeah, but if they are part of like a shared, I don't know, understanding of the world, or like, you know, this is the way the world is or ought to be, or, you know, some sort of like larger cosmology or something, you know, which I know there's debate among folklorists about if fairy tales are trying to do that work or not, but like if they are, you know, like if we take it for granted, like, oh yeah, like there's some sort of symbolism in these, you know, that like help your society or your civilization like hold together, then like what's it say about us like when we don't know them or when we forget them, you know, like I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, but again, no, I don't think anybody would have known all of them.
Right. Yeah, that's a fair point. Anyway, I didn't mean to distract us from thumbling.
I one thing that interests me about him as a trickster is that he pretty much only uses his tricksterism for good. Like he's not really trying to get his own advantage at any point. He doesn't want to die, but other than that, it's always to punish people who are doing the wrong thing.
Yeah, like, that was one of my questions. It was like, I mean, why does he join the thieves, you know? But you're right. It does seem to be that he knows, hey, if I join these thieves, I can thwart their plans, you know, and perhaps get them caught in doing so.
I'm interested in the rich pastor. we're not given any kind of indication about what we're supposed to think about him being rich.
Yeah. 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 Again, going back to what you said earlier, like there's no filling out of characters here. So we really don't get anything about him at all, other than he has a maid. He has a cow. He kills the cow because he thinks the devil's in it, you know.
Well, if your cow started talking.
Yeah. Yeah. But he doesn't. Yeah. It's interesting, though, like a couple questions and Thumbling probably could have explained the situation, but, you know.
People don't ask questions in fairy tales. It's a lot of people who take action without talking about it first.
That's true. There is a lot of they are very action oriented. I think that is part of the charm of them.
Well, the elves is actually three stories. I'm going to give the plot of all three of them because they're all very short, and then we can kind of talk about them one by one. And the first one is the one everybody's heard. It's usually called the Elves and the Shoemaker. You have a poor shoemaker who is down to the leather for his last pair of shoes, and he lays it out the night before, and he's going to make his last ever pair of shoes the next morning, and then I guess starve to death. And when he gets up in the morning, he sees the finest pair of shoes he's ever seen is sitting there, that somebody has come in the middle of the night and turned this leather into just the best shoes in the world. And they're so good that he's able to sell them and buy enough leather to make two more pairs of shoes. And so he lays that leather out that night. And the next morning there's, you know, two of the best pairs of shoes. And so he gets enough to make four, and so on and so on and so on. And finally on Christmas Eve, he and his wife decide to stay up and see what's been going on. And it turns out these naked elves are coming in, and with their tiny little hands, they're able to make super good shoes. And by this point, the cobbler and his wife are rich, and they decide, well, look, maybe we should make them some clothes. And, you know, they're naked. That's not great for them. Why don't we show them we're thankful for what they've done for us by making them clothes? And they do, and they leave them out, and they sit up to watch to see what happens. And the elves are so excited by their clothes that they say they don't have to work anymore. And so they wear the clothes and they leave and they never come back. But the cobbler and his wife are back on their feet and they live happily ever after. So that's the famous one. The second one was less familiar to me. Here we have an industrious servant girl who for some reason is asked by the elves to be the godmother of one of their children. And she goes to the mountains where the elves live, and they're really exceedingly generous with her. And when she leaves to go back to work, they fill her pockets full of money. But when she gets back, she realizes that time passes on Elf Mountain differently than it does in the wide world. And so 7 full years have gone by, and her employers have actually died. And that's the end of the story. And then the third one is the one where you get the elves not being benevolent. They replace a mother's child with a changeling, and they won't return the actual baby until she makes the changeling laugh, at which point I guess they decide no harm, no foul, and return the regular baby, and that's the end of the story. So those are the three stories that are clustered under the title, The Elves. And I guess it makes sense because they're all about elves. But I believe I would have made that third one a second story just because it's so different in tone from the first two. Although I guess all three of them are pretty different.
Yeah, they're strange. It's a strange – trying to connect them is a little hard, you know.
Other than they have elves.
Yeah, they all have elves, but the elves are all behaving very differently. And I don't know, it's elves are such interesting creatures, you know, because there isn't any sort of – I mean, you have everything from, you know, the elves in the Lord of the Rings to, you know, the elves in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer to, you know, Keebler elves. Like, I mean, there's just, they're all over the map as far as, like, what are they and what are they like? You know, they're such liminal creatures, you know?
Right. And especially in these stories, they're not magical, right? The reason the elves are able to make such good shoes is because they have tiny little hands. Mm-hmm. It's not that they have some sort of magic wand that they're waving and making great shoes. So they're strange creatures, but they're not magical creatures as such. At least not in the first story. The second one, maybe. It's hard to tell what's going on with the time.
Yeah, they're definitely the second one's more that kind of Tolkien talks about the perilous realm, you know, like that's the second story, you know, like this maiden unwittingly kind of falls into the land of fairy or the perilous realm, you know, and so then she's there for 7 years, even though she thinks she's only there for 3 days, you know, but that's the whole story. There's nothing else to it. So it's a little unsatisfying.
Well, it's very much like Rip Van Winkle.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
Which
like
is just 7 years after Grimm's Fairy Tales. I mean, they're basically contemporaries.
Yeah,
except I mean, presumably, Washington Irving wrote Rip Van Winkle, and this is, you know, the product of an oral tradition.
Right, but that goes back to that whole like idea that we've been talking about through this whole episode. You know, of like, oh, well, all this stuff is just kind of in the human story, you know. And sometimes they get pulled out, people do different things with them, sometimes, you know, it's just,
you know, it's the same ingredients over and over and over, but sometimes you're able to mix them in such a way that it creates a different flavor. But yeah, it's kind of interesting.
I'm fascinated. All three of these are good. The first one and the second one are particularly good. And the second one is the most interesting to me because it's the most ambiguous. Like, the elves clearly don't wish her ill, or they wouldn't reward her so much. But it's not clear why they chose her to be the godmother. It's not clear what we're supposed to think about her having outlived her employers, because her employers aren't treated as cruel people. They're the ones who encourage her to go to the mountains and work with the elves. It's really a strange little story, very ambiguous.
Yeah, it's extremely ambiguous. Yeah, there's just not much there's something to her, I guess, insisting that it's time for her to leave, because she tries to leave and they, you know, they first implore her to spend 3 days with them. I don't know if that's her industriousness, like she has to get back to work, you know, otherwise she could have been stuck there forever, or, you know, maybe she would be like Rip Van Winkle, and, you know, what Rip Van Winkle is like 100 years or something, isn't it?
He actually ages, whereas she seems to have, you know, like time has just moved differently. So she's the same age she was. She's 3 days older and not 7 years older.
Right.
Rip Van Winkle falls asleep and he ages with everything else.
Fly to the Navigator type situation.
I've not seen that.
Oh, you really? Oh, I haven't seen it since I was a kid, but is the idea that, you know, somebody, I might have the title of the movie wrong, but
no, Flight of the Navigator is the name of that movie.
Okay. Yeah. He goes off into space and travels at the speed of light or whatever. And so when he comes back, like, his younger brother's older than him now. And, you know, he's only been gone for a couple of days. But, yeah.
Einstein's, it's interesting that, like, all that stuff. Somehow the folk stories are picking up on that possibility, which obviously they wouldn't have known how the relativity is a thing.
Right. Yeah. No, there's no way that they would have known that. I think it's the other way. You know, like, it's the science is somehow catching up to, like, this, like, hidden wisdom or something, you know? I don't know. It's weird.
I've often said that if all of modern science was overturned and it turns out the medievals were right about everything, I would be overjoyed.
Yeah. But there is something, too, like, about this, like, about the second and the third tales in particular, where it's like, and we're going to see this again later, too, there's like something about the magic, and there's like rules to the magic. And if you upset the rules, then everything changes, you know? So like there's something about the fact that the shoemaker and his wife give them clothing that like it changes it. Like they don't have to work anymore. And the making the changeling laugh, like, somehow, you know, and I don't know. And there's something about, you know, giving them clothing or tricking them or whatever, you know, like the magic works through these physical things. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and this is something I think we talked about last time too, which is that the magical rules are clearly very intense in the story, but are not defined for us.
Mm-hmm.
As I guess they wouldn't be defined for the people who kind of wander into to fairyland.
Yeah, it's like you get lucky. You
know? Like you unlucky.
Yeah, or unlucky, yeah. You kind of fall into it.
Although, I mean, I'll point out, though, the shoemaker and the servant girl are both really hard workers, because we're told that when the shoemaker goes poor, it's through no fault of his own.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to keep working until he is out of materials. At no point does he, like, give up hope or, like, plan to stop working. And so it does seem like, at least in those first two stories, the elves are attracted to these industrious people.
Yeah.
They're attracted to these people who are simple but who are really hardworking. And they want to reward them. Although wanting to reward them is a weird thing to say about the first tale, because they don't seem to want to reward them exactly. They seem driven to reward them, which is something different.
Yeah, there's something where I don't know. It's hard. It's really hard to tell. Like, I'm aware of this story and I've heard this story told several different ways, you know, but it is always very ambiguous in any retelling about like what exactly are the elves doing there, and why do they leave once they're clothed, you know, like what exactly is it about the clothing that like changes the dynamic or changes the relationship with the shoemaker, you know?
Yeah, once they're rewarded for it, they don't do it anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know.
For the first time this time, like I said, I'm very familiar with the story and I've heard several different versions of it. But this is the first time that I connected it to, I wonder if J.K. Rowling had this in mind when she was thinking of her house elves.
Oh, she had to, right?
If they receive a piece of clothing, they're free. She had to have, but like I never put it together until this time.
I had not remembered the detail that they were naked and that they stopped when they were given clothing. Yeah. I just remember the poor shoemaker being helped by the industrious elves.
Yeah, I thought of Hermione Granger and the Society of the Promotion of Elvish Welfare.
I wonder what they're going to do now. I would love to hear what the story, what version of the story elf mothers tell their children. You know what I mean? Like, what does this look like from the other side?
Right. Yeah. Well, because, like I said, there is that, like, there's that interesting thing with elves where they're like, you know, they're kind of caught in between. Like, they're not humans, obviously, but they're not, you know, angels or something like that. You know, it's like, what are they? And so, yeah, there's a sense, especially in this first story, of like, you know, maybe getting the clothing somehow pulls them fully into one world or the other, you know, like, I don't know.
I wonder if the girl in the second story has to keep going back to take care of her goddaughter.
Yeah, what are her responsibilities there?
It seems like she's just invited to the party.
Yeah, but she is the godmother, right?
Right. Yeah, it's not like it's a, I mean, I guess it could just be a ceremonial role, but if it's really weird that they would even ask a human.
Yeah,
it seems like people know about this because it says her employers finally persuaded her that it would not be wise to refuse the invitation. So like this must be something that occasionally happens.
Yeah. Yeah, there does seem to be more interaction with the magical world or the enchanted world that, you know, people are aware of and like, you know, at least, this is something that may happen to you, you know.
If an elf ever invites you to its birthday party.
Yeah. What do you think about that first story happening like right around Christmas time? Do you think there's anything to that or is that just a detail?
It's a detail and you can never tell what the details mean, right? Because they get accreted through multiple tellings. But most of the rest of the time, you don't know what time of year it is. How many of these others are attached to a particular even season, let alone holiday?
Yeah.
But I mean, it is the time when people give gifts.
Yeah, maybe that's where it is.
And in Germany, do they put stuff in shoes? Or is that just the Netherlands?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. But that would be another connection there too, wouldn't it?
All right. Well, we should talk about the juniper tree.
Yeah.
We both picked this one. This is the one we both picked. And this is like the most famous of the Grimm's tales that never shows up in adaptations or in selective collections. You know what I mean? Like kids don't read this one, but the juniper tree is a super, super famous Grimm story. It's like the most famous adult Grimm story.
Right.
It's their big album cut.
Yeah. Which I didn't know that, but I did know from, from our introduction by Jack Zipes, he mentions two in particular, the fisherman and his wife, which we talked about last time, and this one as, quote, representing in tone, structure, and content, the ideal narrative that the Grimms wanted to create.
Interesting.
And I guess both those stories were written by, like, we know who wrote these ones.
It's like a painter, right?
Yeah, Philip Otto Runge. I don't know how to pronounce his name. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that correctly.
Do you want to, why don't you tell the story? Because I've given the last three or four. People are probably tired of hearing me tell the story.
And speaking of, like you said, like seasons and times, like this one begins with all this took place a long time ago, most likely some 2,000 years ago. So like very vague and not connected to anything, right?
But it's pre-Christian, I think what's interesting about that.
Right.
If it's 2,000 years ago, it's pre-Christian.
Yeah. So a man and woman want a child, and this is very similar to Snow White at the beginning of the story. The traditional Snow White, the woman cuts herself, the blood drips on the snow, and then she wishes for a child as red as blood and as white as snow. And then we do get seasons in this one because it goes through the seasons. The seasons change, and she gives birth to a boy. And she's so delighted that she dies at the birth of this child. And she had asked that if she died, that she gets buried under this juniper tree. So her husband buries her under the juniper tree. And as in all these fairy tales, the man gets remarried, and there's the evil stepmother, and she has a daughter already. And the daughter gets a name in this one, which is interesting to me, because usually it's the maiden or the young girl or whatever. So the daughter
is the only person in the story with a name, right? Marlena?
Yeah, Marlena. So anyway, the new wife loves Marlena, but hates the boy. And one day the devil seemed to take possession of her, is the way that they describe it in the story. And she offers the boy an apple. And when he reaches into the chest to draw it out, she slams the lid down and beheads him. So then she sits him on the porch with a kerchief around his neck and an apple in his hand. And Marlena becomes concerned because her brother's not responding to her. And so her mom says, well, if he doesn't answer you, give him a box in the ear. And so Marlena does this, and his head falls off. So she thinks that she has knocked her brother's head off, and she's weeping unconsolably. And the mother acts like it's Marlena's fault, but she offers to cook the boy in a stew so that no one will find out about it. And when the father comes home and asks where the boy is, the stepmother lies, says he's visiting relatives, and then she feeds dad the stew. So we get the cannibalism that we referenced earlier. And the weird thing is the father says it tastes amazing, and he won't let them share it. He says, I feel like it belongs all to me, and he eats it all. And he's throwing the bones on the floor as he eats. And Marlena is collecting the bones and crying as she does it. And she collects them all in her silk neckerchief, and she lays them under the juniper tree. And then the juniper tree seems to clap its hands for joy, and there's smoke and a flame, and a beautiful bird appears. And this bird flies to a goldsmith, and it sings this song, and I'm just going to read it straight from the book. It says, my mother, she killed me. My father, he ate me. My sister Marlena, she made sure to see. My bones were gathered together, bound nicely in silk, as neat as can be, and laid beneath the juniper tree. Tweet, tweet, what a lovely bird I am. So this is the refrain that gets told over and over, because the goldsmith wants to hear it again. And he says, well, I only sing once for free. And so the goldsmith gives him a chain. And so the bird sings it again. And then he goes to a shoemaker and he sings it. And the same thing, the shoemaker wants to hear it again, but he says, you know, I don't sing for free. And so he gives him some red shoes. And then he flies to a mill, and there's 20 workers working on this huge stone, and they stop to listen. But the last one doesn't hear the whole song. They all agree that they'll give the bird the stone if he sings again. So now the bird has a necklace in his right claw, shoes in his left, and a millstone around his neck, and he flies home. And the dad is feeling better and better all the time. And Marlene is still weeping, and the mother is getting more and more terrified. And the bird begins singing. The father goes out to hear it, and the bird gives him the golden chain. It falls right around his neck. And the mother is getting worse and worse as this is going on. And the father comes in and says, this bird gave me a chain. So Marlena goes out to see if she'll get a gift. The bird sings again, gives her the shoes. Marlena goes dancing back into the house. The mother feels like the world is ending. It says her hair's like on fire, and like, or it doesn't, like, not literally on fire, but like that, you know, like her hair's like all standing on end. And so she runs outside to try and get like some fresh air. And of course the bird drops the millstone on her and crushes her. And then at the same time, smoke and flames come up, and then the boy is standing there again. And he takes his father's and Marlena's by the hand, and all three of them were very happy, and they go inside and they eat. The end.
Yeah,
I feel like this story is like I understand why it's the most famous one. Like, I wouldn't have known that until you said that, but like, I totally understand. Like, I mentioned earlier, we read so many of these and it's easy to get them mixed up and it's easy to forget them. But like, this one, like, lodged in my brain when I read it. It's like, I must understand this story. Like,
yeah. It's one of those that it seems like there's something really, really deep underneath it, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, and that Philip Otto Runge or whatever, like, his paintings are known for being, like, deep in symbolism. So I'm just sure there's a ton of symbolism in here that I am just not getting at all. But it's still a fascinating story, even without understanding all the symbolism of it.
He had it as the almond tree, right?
Oh, I don't know. Is that true? Maybe.
I think that's right. And I think the original version, or, you know, I'm sorry, there is no original version, but the non Runge versions were the juniper tree, and that's why they use juniper tree, even though they kind of modeled it on his version, the almond tree.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like, what juniper is associated with. All I know is that, you know, that's what they make gin out of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I looked it up just to try and get a sense of it, but it wasn't really clear. Like, there's some, like, cleansing and purity or something, maybe, but, like, I don't know, it wasn't clear to me, like, what the symbolism of the juniper is supposed to be.
But yeah, you have this horrible, like, what she does is bad enough, her killing the kid, but then making her daughter think that it was her fault and then feeding him to the father. Like, why couldn't she have just buried him under the tree? Why did she need to eat him? What was the, like, what she does is so terrible, and it makes sense then that it would say the devil seemed to take possession of her. But also, isn't that the language that the Gospel of Matthew uses for Judas right before he betrays Christ?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So this,
and then
is like,
you get the millstone, which is, that's Luke. You, whoever would harm one of these little ones, it would be better for him if a millstone was tied around his neck.
Yeah. And this is like a huge millstone. Like, it takes 20 men to lift it.
But a bird can carry it.
Yeah, but a bird can carry it. That's no problem. But but this is a magical bird. The magical bird I have a lot of questions about, because, like, it's singing this beautiful song that everyone wants to hear. But, like, the words are horrible.
Who knows? You know? Who knows what birds are singing? We just can't understand it.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I couldn't, like, are they understanding the words, or are they just hearing the bird song? Because they seem to communicate with the bird. You know, he says, "I don't sing twice for free," and they're giving him. I don't know. It's very unusual. Very unusual.
Well, a lot of those folk songs are kind of, you know, murder ballads and other sorts of terrible stuff.
Yeah,
or
maybe
even like a story like this. Like, this is a story that gets told and told and told and told. Even though it's awful.
Yeah, you're right.
Like, really incredibly dark.
Yeah.
I mean, probably the darkest one we've looked at, although it does have a happy ending.
Yeah, it does have a very happy ending for all but the mother, right?
Right. Well, and even she died of joy.
I meant the stepmother.
Oh, the stepmother. Yeah, you're right. Well, she got what she deserved.
Yeah.
Yeah, so justice is done to the stepmother. The natural mother dies of joy giving birth to him. So it's hard to see that as a terrible ending for her. She got what she wanted. Her son is going to be okay. He's apparently protected by some sort of ancient magic.
Mm-hmm.
Marlena is going to be traumatized, I suspect, but I guess the kid comes back from the dead, so.
She got new shoes out of the deal.
The father, I wonder if he ever found out that he ate his son.
Yeah, that would be traumatizing in itself, right?
And the implication is that all of this magic happened because the bones were buried in the same place where the mother's body was buried, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You've got that kind of Cinderella situation where she's watching over him from the grave.
Yeah. Yeah, a mother's love.
Well, and again, I mean, the mother's love is enough to make him come into the world, right? Like, she wants him to exist so badly that he exists.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is something we saw also in Thumbling.
Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of resonances there.
I don't know.
What do you think about this line? So the goldsmith is sitting in his workshop making a golden chain, and when he heard the bird singing on his roof, he thought it was very beautiful. Then he stood up, and as he walked across the threshold, he lost a slipper. Still, he kept on going right into the middle of the street with only one sock and a slipper on. Isn't that like a bizarre detail?
I guess it's just supposed to show you how beautiful the song is. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I was just really struck by that. I was like, it must mean something. Like, you lose a slipper. I don't know. Like, that's very Cinderella-ish also, right? Like, it's just this one in particular, it just felt like this, like, it lives in the fairy tale realm. Like, all these, like, fairy tale things are happening at the same time.
Yeah, but also it's just, it's so hideous too.
Yeah.
Which, and I get that other ones are also like ones that we're familiar with because of the way in which we become familiar with them. They don't read as awful to us, but I don't know. I just can't think of one in which things as heinous as this happen that people are familiar with.
Yeah.
I guess Snow White is pretty heinous. If you really think about it.
Yeah. I don't know. They are. this one, I mean, I think what you're feeling is the it's got the multiplying effect of, like, it's got cannibalism and it's also got beheading and it's also got, like, traumatizing a child. like it's just like they pile on top of each other, you know, like
the most wicked stepmother in all of literature.
Yes, the most wicked Snow White's stepmom is bad, and she definitely tries to kill Snow White. Like, there's no getting around that, but she doesn't try to feed Snow White to the king, you know.
the devil doesn't take possession of her,
right?
Her eyes don't go black.
Yeah, it's pretty creepy. Pretty creepy. Yeah, it's a fascinating story, though. I would love to know more about it. Well, there are lots of turning into books. No, not turning into books, turning into birds. And we're going to get another turning into birds one with the six swans. Are you ready for that? Or do you have more?
I could not be more ready. Der Sex Schwäne, I think it's pronounced. I'm trying to learn German. I think it's pronounced the Der Sex, Die Sex Schwäne.
Okay. All right. Well, this one's fun. Let's see. Sorry, I got to scroll on my notes here. So once there was a king who was hunting in a vast forest, and he was chasing a deer so intensely that none of his men could follow him. Great, great story. Great beginning to these stories, right? So he runs into a witch, and she makes him promise to marry her daughter. And her daughter is very beautiful, but it says he couldn't look at her without secretly shuddering. So he hid his seven children, who he had from his first wife, deep in the forest. And he could only get to the castle where they're hidden with a magical ball of yarn that would unwind and show you the way. And the witch, or the witch's daughter, starts noticing that the king is often absent because he's going to visit his children. So she bribes a servant, and the servant tells her about the magical ball of yarn. She discovers the magical ball of yarn, follows it into the woods. She brings six magical shirts with her into the forest, and she throws them on the six boys. The six sons run out to greet her, thinking it's their father coming to visit. And as she throws the shirts on them, they become swans. And the witch doesn't know about the seventh child, who is a daughter. So then the daughter goes out to look for her brothers, and she comes upon a hut with six beds, and she's too exhausted to go any farther, just like you always are when you come to a hut. And she's resting inside, and her brothers fly in, and they shed their feathers, and they take their human form. So everything seems awesome, but then they're like, no, this is actually a robber's den, and you have to leave, because of course it's a robber's den.
Hey, look, if you find a house in the middle of the forest, it's either going to belong to robbers or to dwarves.
Yeah.
Those are your options. So if the beds are normal sized, be careful.
Yeah. So anyway, she's like, well, why can't you just protect me from the robbers? But they're like, oh, we only get 15 minutes each evening that we turn into human form. But they say, if you go 6 years without speaking or laughing, and you make six little shirts out of aster flowers, then we can be turned human again. but they're kind of doubtful that she can do this. So she leaves the hut. She's found by some huntsmen. She's already taken this vow of silence, so she doesn't talk to them, but they take her to the king. The king falls in love with her. This is a different king, not her father, the king. King falls in love with her, marries her, but he has an evil stepmother, or not stepmother, maybe just mother, evil queen mother, and she disapproves of this marriage. So after they have their first child, the evil queen mother steals the child and accuses the young queen of cannibalism. And she can't defend herself because she's not speaking. And then this happens two more times. And so finally, even though the king loves her, he doesn't actually believe she's a cannibal. He has to turn over to the court and she's going to be burned at the stake. But the whole time, the young queen has just been diligently working at these six shirts for her brothers and not saying a word and not laughing. So the day of her sentence is the last day of the 6 years. And she brings the shirts with her to the stake where she's going to be burned. And all of them are done, but one. One is unfinished. So her brothers fly in just in time, just as the fire is about to be lit. She throws them the shirts. They're all transformed. The one brother who gets the unfinished shirt has one wing instead of his left arm. And so then she's finally able to speak again, and she defends herself. She accuses the queen mother. The queen mother brings the children out of hiding, so everybody rejoices. But then the queen mother is punished by she becomes the one who ends up burned at the stake instead.
Burned to ashes.
To ashes. That's right. So this story, we get more turning into birds.
There's at least two other we've read so far, right? The seven ravens and the 12 brothers.
Yeah. There's a lot where people turn into birds.
And we have mass numbers of siblings being turned into birds.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it's always the daughter, always the youngest one, and she's always a girl, and she's the one who has to kind of go through the sacrificial process to turn them back into human beings.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and you see that even a little bit in the juniper tree, right? Like it doesn't say if Marlene is older than or younger than him, but you know, it's her care for his bones that, you know, turns him in some ways, like I guess turns him first into a bird and then out of a bird. So yeah.
Yeah.
And then you have more of this, like the power of laughter, you know, like in that elf story that we read, you know, like it's if you can make the thing laugh, then that like breaks the spell. And in this case, it's like, don't laugh or, you know, the spell will be, you know, stayed that way forever. So
it's a good thing she doesn't live with me.
Yeah, that's right. You'd be making her laugh all the time and her brothers would be swans forever.
Maybe that's why my wife doesn't laugh at any of my jokes. Maybe maybe this is part of a long-term process of turning her six brothers back into human beings from swords.
Yeah.
If I were that sixth brother, I'd be like, hey, how come you didn't just tear off the other sleeve too so that I could have two wings? Because I feel like one wing and one arm is the worst of both worlds. But two wings? I could live with that.
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting. It's weird. Yeah, I just have a lot of questions this time, you know. Like
I love the detail there, like that the magic is that specific that it has to be a perfectly completed shirt. What would have happened if she, when she'd thrown it at them, she'd missed?
Right.
This is one of the few times we've seen where somebody beautiful is not good. The witch's daughter is beautiful, but he can't look at her without shuddering. I mean, usually. Usually beauty and goodness are synonymous for women in these fairy tales. And even here, the king's daughter is both good and beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I'm trying to remember in the one we read last time with the she goes and gets the strawberries and then the other daughter goes to get the strawberries, but the other daughter's a jerk. I remember she's a jerk.
Yeah.
But is she beautiful also or not?
I can't remember if she was beautiful or not.
Yeah. But no, I mean, you're right. It is rare. I'm not trying to dispute your point. I was just trying to remember when you said that. If we have not read many like that at all. You're right.
This is another story where characters just kind of drop out. We never hear about the first king again. We never hear about the witch. We never hear about the stepmother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just, she kind of like, does her damage and is gone.
they're just gone.
Yeah.
Which, it's just the way the stories work. I'm not complaining about it, but it is like if what you're used to is contemporary fiction, this is just – it just drops characters left and right. Maybe when we get to the very end of the book, we'll find out what happens to all the dropped characters.
maybe somebody should write that book, you know?
That's probably happened.
Oh yeah, that's probably true. Somebody's written the book of all the kingdoms with, you know, no children because they've run off to, you know, go get married in some other place. And
there's a number of kind of postmodern fiction writers who have done adaptations of Grimm's. The two that come to mind, Robert Coover did some a few years ago that were pretty, in fact, he did one of the Juniper Tree. I remember it from the New Yorker. And I cannot remember the woman's name. I used to teach her, Angela something. She did an adult version of Beauty and the Beast. Adult not meaning, you know, like right. Explicit.
Yeah, just not for kids.
Just not for kids.
Yeah.
But that was a popular thing for a while to do kind of literary retellings of these in using the conventions of contemporary fiction.
Yeah.
What made you like this one more than like The Seven Ravens or The 12 Brothers? Or did you just decide, having read the story for the third time, that we needed to talk about it because it's such a thing?
Yeah, I think that was the main thing. Like, I knew there was a few others that we could choose. I kind of flipped through them all, and I liked the element. Like, they don't all have all the same elements. They have similar elements, but I kind of liked the elements in this one. Like, I like the magical ball of yarn, and, you know, like, I don't know. It felt like it had a lot of the classic fairy tale tropes, but also some that, before reading this book, I was not expecting. Like, you know, I've mentioned them today. Like, I was not expecting the amount of, like, letters getting lost or, you know, mistranslated. I was not expecting the amount of people turning into birds. I was not expecting the amount of resurrection. Like, I knew resurrection was a thing, but I feel like there's resurrection in, like, every other story. Somebody's getting resurrected, you know? Like, it's just, I was not expecting the amount of it. So this has been really, really fun read through, because there's just a lot that keeps coming up. And so, yeah, I thought it was worthwhile to, you know, just to highlight it as like, this is something that's in this book a lot.
the stories all kind of have Christian shapes without being allegories. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, you can tell they come from a Christian culture because they have a kind of Christian valence to them, but it's not like some youth pastor sat down and decided to write stories to illustrate Christianity or something like that. No offense to any youth pastors listening.
Right, yeah. But they are, in some ways, like...
deeply Christian.
Yeah, deeply Christian. And that's what I mean, like, when it concerns me when I don't understand them. Because I'm like, how shallowly Christian am I? You know, that, like, there's, like, something, like... I feel like there's probably something really important about the fact that there's like six brothers and one sister and they add up to seven, you know, like there's something I should know there. There's something I should know about, like, why does that last brother have one wing and one arm? But it's like,
I just think that's a funny little detail. I don't think you should try to allegorize everything.
Yeah. I don't mean allegorizing it though. Like, I mean, like you said, like there's something deeply Christian about it. Like, but I can't put my finger on it, you know?
Like, I think the power of the stories is that they don't totally make sense.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, if they were written by a person in order to sell you merchandise, they would make total sense. There would not be loose ends, because they don't want people asking, well, how come that happened? How come? What happened to the king? What happened to the witch? But because these are written, these kind of emerge out of, you know, folk culture, because there is no one writer, because there are a million different versions and we just got a snapshot of one of them. They don't hold together the way popular media holds together, which is I think really the source of their power. And it's why people want to write new versions of them, because there's this sense that there's something strange and luminous in them that evades our understanding.
Right. But if I'm sitting around, like let's say I was sitting around a campfire with Wilhelm Grimm and he's telling me one of these stories, you know, like, do you think the original hearers, I mean, well, even then, they're not the original hearers. That's kind of your point, right? Is like,
there is no original down hearer.
The line. But you know what I mean? Like, the people at the time, are they getting more than I'm getting?
That's an interesting question. And I think for our next set, you know, finish Grimm. I don't mean next month, but after we do Grimm, we're going to have to pick somebody else to do. I think we should do something that was written by one person at a point in time. We should do like Rudyard Kipling's Just So stories, or maybe like Hans Christian Andersen, or something else where you have somebody in the modern age sitting down and writing his own stories, and seeing if seeing how that's different from what's going on here.
Yeah.
Because those are technically not folktales, right? Like Hans Christian Andersen is, as far as I don't know, but as far as I know, he's making them up.
Mm-hmm.
Rudyard Kipling is making up the Just So stories. They're not actually folk stories from India. But again, I don't know. I haven't read either one of those things. So I would be interested in seeing if something where you have one author and it's very clear, if it lacks the kind of weird luminous quality of the Grimms because it doesn't emerge from folk culture.
Yeah. Could be fun.
But look, we got to move on because we still have two more to talk to. And
we do.
I want to talk about this next one.
Okay. Yeah. You and I both really enjoyed this next one. It's called King Thrushbeard. So a king has a daughter. Her beauty is beyond comparison, but she's super proud and haughty. So no suitor is good enough for her. She makes fun of everyone's appearance who comes, calls them names. And one suitor in particular has a crooked chin, and she says it was like a thrush's beak. And from then on, everyone called him Thrushbeard. So her father is understandably exasperated by this and says he's going to wed her to the next beggar who comes begging. So a few days later, a minstrel comes along. The king gives his daughter to him. He takes her home. And as they pass a forest, a meadow, a city, at each point, she's asking, who do these belong to? And each time the minstrel's saying, oh, these are King Thrushbeard's. If you had, you know, married him, then they'd belong to you now. And every time she's saying, oh, alas, poor me, if only I knew. So they get to the minstrel's house, and it's just a tiny house and no servants, you know, which is shocking to her. And she doesn't know how to do any housekeeping, and the minstrel has to show her everything. And eventually they're basically running out of provisions. So he tries to have her weave baskets. He tries to have her spin. But she's like too tender to do anything. You know, she's lived this completely royal lifestyle where she's never had to do anything. So finally he gets, some pots and earthenware for her to sell. And this actually goes well because she's so beautiful that people just come to buy from her because she's beautiful. And sometimes they even forget to take what they bought. They just basically are giving her money because she's...
You know what it's talking about, right, Josh?
No, I have no idea. So anyway, she sets up on a street corner and a drunken cavalryman comes galloping along and he smashes all the pots. And her husband's like totally like, oh, man, I got a bad deal with you. And tells her she was foolish to set up in that area and, you know, you can't do anything right. But I got you a job as a kitchen maid in the castle. So she starts working in the kitchen maid. She has to do all the lowest work. And at this point, it tells us that she's finally becoming repentant about her pride and her arrogance that has brought her to such humiliation and poverty. So she sews these small jars into her clothes so that she can take leftover food home from working in the kitchen for her and her husband to eat. And one night she's watching a great banquet and King Thrushbeard himself shows up. And he pulls her into the banquet hall to dance with her. And she's horrified by this because she knows, like, oh, I rejected this guy. And, you know, like, I'm married to this other minstrel. And, you know, like, I mean, she's just horrified by the whole thing. And so she's struggling with him. And in the struggle, the jars of food crash to the floor and the soup and the food scraps goes everywhere. And everybody laughs at her. And she's horrified and embarrassed. And she runs away. And King Thrushbeard catches her. And at that point, he explains that he has been the minstrel and he was also the cavalryman. And he has done all of this out of love for her that she might learn humility. And even at that point, she says she doesn't deserve to be his wife. But then he says the bad days are over and they dress her in splendid clothes and the real rejoicing begins and they live happily ever after.
Yeah, this one just seems profoundly Christian to me in a way that's not just like a simple allegory. But you get this sense that she's refusing grace right at the beginning. She thinks she's earned all these things that she doesn't earn. The reason she thinks she's better than everybody is because she's beautiful and because she has the social position that she's inherited. But of course, she didn't do anything to earn either one of those things, which means there's nothing she should be particularly pleased with herself for. So over the course of the story, she learns that she doesn't have anything. And she, by the end, she's totally at the mercy of this person. And she learns that the grace she's going to be given is going to elevate her to a position even higher than the one she thought she occupied at the beginning of the story. It's really profoundly Christian.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love the, you know, it's the pursuit of him, of her, you know, and he's doing all these things out of love. And I mean, it's hard lessons, you know, like, but, you know, he's still, you know, it's all from a position of love in order, like you said, to elevate her,
right.
Like elevate her, positionally, but like elevate her character. Like now she can be a true queen who rules her people, you know, rightly or whatever, you know, like.
That's right. She has to be humbled. She has to lose this part of herself that was holding her back. It's really beautiful. The way at the end he says, "I and the minstrel who lived with you in the wretched cottage are one and the same person. I disguised myself out of love for you, and I was also the hussar who rode over your pots and smashed them to pieces. I did all that to humble your proud spirit and to punish you for the insolent way you behaved toward me." What it reminds me of even more than like the God of the Bible is Chesterton's The Man Who Was Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
Have you read that?
I have read it, yes.
Yeah, so like that's another, it feels like a fairy tale in the sense that it's got that kind of weird, luminous quality where things don't really hold together. It has dream logic. And you get, I don't want to spoil anything for our listeners who haven't read The Man Who Was Thursday, but it's a great book. And you get this character, Sunday, who is all sorts of things that you do not imagine that he is. And he kind of represents God, I guess, in a certain way in that novel, but also he doesn't. Anyway, that's really what that passage at the end made me think of. Is it sounds very much like something Sunday would say. And what's mm-hmm. The line that Chesterton uses is that his jokes are so big that nobody, so big and obvious that no one had ever thought of them. And I think you could say the same thing of King Thrushbeard. And I wonder if Chesterton had King Thrushbeard in mind when he wrote The Man Who Was Thursday, because obviously this predates that.
Right. Yeah, that's a great parallel. I bet he did, because he's so, you know, Chesterton is so immersed in all this stuff. So it would make total sense. But yeah. And I really love that. Like, I mean, there's something so incarnational about that image too, right? Like, he's the king. He could be living in luxury and with servants.
Right, he has to live as a beggar.
He lives as a beggar, you know, while she's learning all this stuff. And
he's doing it to humble her, which that's what he says, but also he's going to have to be humble even in order to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's not like, yeah, he's already humble enough himself to take on that task, you know. Like if he had been proud or haughty at all, he would have been like, well, I don't need this. I'll go find some other princess, you know.
right. And presumably he could have had almost anybody he wanted except her.
Yeah.
And also the thing she's making fun of him for is so minor compared to what she's making fun of all these other guys for. Right? Like his nose is a little crooked or his chin is a little bit crooked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. So this minor thing, it's kind of Seinfeldian, right? This minor thing that she's picked on him for.
Right.
She has man hands.
Yeah. Yeah, Seinfeld. That's really funny. Seinfeld is totally this princess. That's very true.
Seinfeld and The Man Who Was Thursday. There's the key to understanding King Thrushbeard.
Yeah, I think you guys had an episode on The Man Who Was Thursday, didn't you?
We did, yeah.
Yeah, so when I say you guys, listeners, you probably know.
Regular Christian Humanist podcast.
Yes, the Christian Humanist Mothership podcast. Years and years ago did one on The Man Who Was Thursday. So if you want to read the book, listen to their commentary.
Or just read the book. If you haven't read The Man Who Was Thursday and you enjoy these fairy tales, you would probably enjoy The Man Who Was Thursday. Because it does have that same logic.
Yes, that same
that logic that doesn't quite hold together.
But it's like you said in the on with both this one and the one before it, like it doesn't feel like nonsense not holding together. It feels like there's something extremely deep to it. Like there's right. something underneath it that actually is holding it together, you know? So, yeah. Well, yeah, that was a great one. And yeah, I think you said that was out of the 89 or whatever that we've read, that's maybe your favorite. So I agree. That was a top notch one.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think there's one I've liked more than that one. Certainly not one I didn't know beforehand, because I'd never heard of King Thrushbeard.
Yeah, neither had I.
I'd never heard of Sweetheart Roland either, which is our last one.
Yeah, let's wrap it up here. So, once upon a time, there was a wicked witch who lived with her daughter and her stepdaughter, and the daughter was ugly and evil, and the stepdaughter was beautiful and good. There you go, Michael. This is what we're talking about. So the stepdaughter, the ugly stepdaughter, covets her sister's beautiful apron. She tells her mother she wants it. The witch says, "That's great. I was planning on killing your sister anyway." So she's going to chop off the sister's head while they sleep. But the good and the beautiful daughter overhears the plan, and she switches places in bed. So the witch ends up beheading her own daughter. So then the maiden, she flees to her sweetheart Roland's house, and she tells him what's happened, and that in the morning the witch is going to be furious because she's going to realize that she killed her own daughter. So Roland advises her, well, you better steal the witch's wand or we'll never escape. And so she goes back and she gets the witch's wand, and then she also, this is a weird detail, but she takes the head of her stepsister, and it's not really important later in the story except that 3 drops of blood fall on the floor, and that's how the witch discovers that her daughter is dead, is because these drops of blood basically tell her that the daughter is dead. So anyway, her and Roland, they run away. So in the morning, the witch calls out to her daughter, the drops of blood call out to her and say, you know, she discovers that, you know, she's beheaded her own daughter. So she runs to the window. She's got far sight because she's a witch, and she can see Roland and the maiden. So she puts on her 7-league boots, which allow her to cover an hour's walk in one step, and she chases down the couples. But just before she arrives, they see her coming, and the maiden transforms Roland into a lake, and she transforms herself into a duck, and she's swimming on the lake. And the witch comes, and she tries to entice the duck off the lake. She can't, and at nightfall, she has to leave. So then they travel all night, but again, the witch catches up to him the next day. But this time the maiden transforms herself into a flower, which is growing in the middle of a hedge, like a briar hedge. And Roland turns into a fiddler. And the witch comes and she says to Roland, "Can I pick that flower?" And Roland says, "Yeah, sure, no problem." But as soon as she crawls into the hedge, he plays a magical song on the fiddle, which causes her to dance uncontrollably. She can't stop dancing until she has been stabbed to death by the briar hedge. And the thorns tear her apart and she dies. So now they're free of the witch. Roland says, "I will go arrange our wedding." And the maiden says, "I'm going to turn myself into a redstone and wait for your return." And so Roland goes back to his kingdom, but while there, he gets ensnared by another woman and he forgets all about the maiden. So when Roland doesn't return, the maiden turns herself into a flower to get trampled on, but a shepherd finds her and plucks her and takes her to his home. And when he does this, all these magical things start happening at his house. So chores are completed while he's sleeping, or he goes out to watch his sheep and he comes back and dinner's ready. And so a wise woman tells him to keep his eyes open and throw a white cloth over anything that moves, and this will stop the magic. So he stays awake and the flower moves. He throws the white cloth. She turns into the maiden and he's like, "This is great. You should marry me." But she says, "No, I have this sweetheart, Roland, and I'm still devoted to him." So then the invitation to Roland's wedding, Roland is getting married to this other enchantress, and the invitation comes, and she is compelled to go. All the other maidens in the village say she has to go, and so she goes. And the custom is that all the maidens have to sing at the wedding, and she keeps, like, avoiding her turn, but finally she's the last one to go, and so she has to sing a solo, and Roland recognizes her voice, and that breaks the spell on him. He remembers her as his true bride and marries her. So I feel like a lot of the, and that's the end of that story. I feel like a lot of the themes that we've been talking about today pop up again in this story. Like, we've got the people turning into birds. We've got, much like the elves, somehow the clothing or the cloth thing, you know, like the elves work magically in the night and she works magically in the night until she gets clothing. And then that stops it, you know, that breaks the spell.
You get a song that's irresistible.
You get a song that's irresistible. You get, just a lot of the same things we've been talking about all throughout. So in that way, it's kind of an appropriate place to end. I didn't pick it that for that reason, but I kind of recognized that as we went through, like, oh yeah, that's going to come up again and again in Sweetheart Roland.
Yeah. She's like ridiculous faithful to him, like really beyond all hope, right? Like, if you knew this woman in real life, you would tell her to get over him. But he's, you know, he's a cad. He's moved on. She should also move on. But in fact, he hadn't really moved on. He was just like mistaken about who he was and what he needed.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as he actually hears her voice again, he realizes that he doesn't want anybody but her. Everything that he had forgotten and everything that had vanished from his mind suddenly filled his heart again.
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, it's a very happy ending. It's really like nice, you know?
Yeah, it's like he's been enchanted by this other woman. I'm trying to see if somehow.
Yeah, it does say that. It says that.
Ensnared by another woman who made him forget the maiden. I wonder if, like, how metaphorical is that? Has a witch put a spell on him? Or is it just that he is kind of a cad and this other woman seduces him?
Yeah, I don't know. Because, like you said, it's everything that he had forgotten, everything that had vanished from his mind suddenly filled his heart again. So I don't know. I took it as magical. But maybe you're right. Maybe it's...
There's certainly a lot of magic going on in the story.
If that's the case, it's a much less happy ending, because what's to prevent that from happening again? You know?
Yeah. Well, presumably he'll hear her sing every day.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
This is another one that just does not at all end where it begins.
Yeah, because at the beginning you've got the two sisters and, I don't know, we've got more beheading happening here.
You feel bad for the evil stepsister.
Yeah, this one's a lot more brutal in the sense that, like, it says, like, her body's, like, swimming in the blood or whatever. Like,
yeah. I noticed that.
Yeah, with the juniper tree, she cuts off the head, but, you know, then she just can, like, kind of hide it with a neckerchief. So, like, it's, you know, the gore is missing. This one, there's a lot more gore.
What did she see but her own daughter swimming in blood?
Yeah, it's bad. It's bad.
It's a horror movie.
I think it's much more realistic, probably. I've never beheaded someone, but I imagine there's a lot of blood that comes out.
I'm reading A Tale of Two Cities, and the guillotine certainly seems to release a lot of blood to hear the descriptions.
Yes. Well, I didn't have much to say about this one. I just, why a duck and a lake?
Yeah, I like that. Like, whoever heard of being turned into a lake?
Yeah. It's kind of cool.
But she's like subsumed in him, you know, like he's protecting her.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the image.
And I guess the same is true of the, he's not the Briarhead. She's the Fiddler.
Yeah.
That makes less sense.
Yeah. That does make less sense. Except he's been able to play the tune to eliminate the witch. The Seven League boots show up. I feel like those are, you know, another one of those classic fairy tale things. So, but that's about all I have to say about it. So,
well, we actually got ahead of things this month. I guess we had an extra month to do it, but we know which stories we're talking about next month, so we don't have to put out an announcement in a few weeks. So why don't you go ahead and let our listeners know which stories we're going to talk about.
All right. We'll be doing seven next time, because the way we do this is Michael picks five and I pick five. And if we happen to overlap, then we just get excited that we both are talking about a story that we want to. So this time we actually overlapped on three, which is kind of fun. So the stories we'll be talking about are The Golden Bird, The Two Brothers, The 12 Huntsmen, The Three Sons of Fortune, The Wolf and the Fox, Brother Lustig, and The Goose Girl.
Once again, we're doing the first one and the last one in the page range.
Ooh, I did not realize that.
Although I think this time I'm the one who picked the first and the last one.
You are. That's funny.
All right. Well, we will we'll see you all in, well, not even a month. It'll be 3 weeks because we recorded this episode late, which I guess means we better get cracking.
Yeah, you better get cracking, Michael. So anyway, our press liaison is Kristen Filipic, and we're on the old interwebs at christianhumanist.org. And you can help us continue this conversation by reaching out to us at beforetheywerelive@gmail.com. And we also want to encourage you to set your podcast player's dials to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, where you'll find some old shows and some occasional new shows to keep you going. Go look up The Man Who Is Thursday on the old Christian Humanist Christian Humanist podcast. Michael and I know there are a great number of podcasts out there you could be spending your time on, so thank you for spending the time with us. So for Michael Farmer, I'm Joshua Altman, chauffeur. Oh my, I'm stuffed. Enough's enough. Meh, meh.